Hello, I'm Dr. Stephen Hassan with another episode of the Influence Continuum. Ever think about taking martial arts or know someone who got into martial arts? I know I did. One area that we haven't covered yet on our podcast and in blogs is the issue of martial arts cults. And I reached out to an old friend, colleague, person that I talked with when he first exited the cult. I think it was in 1991 or something, 90 or 91, long time ago when we were youngsters. Is Russell Johnson, who joins me now. And Russ, I'll just read a little bit more that you got involved in this martial arts cult at the tender age of 16. You didn't realize the leader of this martial arts organization was functioned like a cult leader, claimed to be a master who had spiritual supernatural powers. And you got deep into the world of Chung Mu Kwan and the master John C. Kim, a Korean martial arts cult, I might add. You were, I think, involved for 8 years, and you had a near-fatal training injury, which led to you meeting with an attorney to discuss your injuries, and she's the one who said, "It sounds like you've been in a cult, Russell." And your story, which you will share, was that you went to a local library, found combating cult mind control, contacted me, I guess, in 1990. And yeah, there's been a documentary. You have a podcast about this cult and other martial arts cult. And you were an activist, a successful activist. And combined with those of others, it ultimately led to a 1996 conviction of the cult leader Kim and 13 of his top instructors for conspiracy to defraud the United States of America. And most recently, you shared that some DNA evidence connected to some murder, but we won't get into the details of that because I don't know what that is. But Russell Johnson, how are you?
I'm doing good, Steve. It's thank you for having me on your show, and it's good to see you again. You really had an influence on my life and the direction when I was starting out my investigation of Chung Mu Kwan, and your book, Combating Cult Mind Control, really, that's what made me realize that I was in a cult.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, so let's flesh out the details. I know many of my listeners know about my model of looking at behavior control and information control and thought control and emotional control. Back in the original edition of the book, it wasn't called the BITE model, but the four components were there. Break it down a little bit more. So maybe people who have been involved with a martial arts group might turn on some light bulbs.
Sure. I think easiest place is to start for me from the beginning when I was 16.
Great.
And like many other kids my age, I looked to take martial arts. Now, my home life, I had a wonderful mother, but we grew up in low income housing, and I had experienced a lot of violence and things in my life, traumatization, that kind of made me the perfect victim for them. And so I went to a martial arts school in a strip mall that was a front for a destructive cult. It was sold to me that it was 8 martial arts taught as one, that the master had schools all over the world. And there was a hidden agenda that, had I been aware of, I never would have joined the school to begin with. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things that happened to me as I went into the schools, the instructor there, he did a demonstration, and he told me to throw a punch at him. And I threw a punch at him, and the next thing I know, I was getting hit like multiple times. And this is a very important part of the school's indoctrination process, because it set up the instructor as the dominant and the student as the submissive. It right away, there was that relationship as soon as you walked in the door. The fraud and deception, there was no schools in other countries. The certifications on the wall were fake. And so it was almost like a film set where everything was what you would expect it to be. I was a fan of the Kung Fu TV series. And
me too.
I love that show. And for me,
David Carradine.
Yes.
And Bruce Lee was also very cool.
And
the Green Hornet.
Exactly. And Kim, actually, the master, actually claimed to be Bruce Lee's teacher, and that he had him killed. And I wouldn't find this stuff out till later on in the process. Mm-hmm. And so when I first got there, I met this man who was one of Kim's instructors. Mm-hmm. And right away, I was like, he was actually kind of the real deal. And somehow he got brainwashed by Kim. And prior to becoming involved in the cult, he actually was taught by Cam Yoon, who did teach David Carradine. And he actually went on to the Kung Fu show for the choreographing with Cam Yoon, his master at that time.
So just for my listeners to be clear, there was a one of the students of the cult leader was actually a martial arts master taught by a legitimate martial arts master, but he was brainwashed to believe Kim had all these powers and was
exactly
better than him.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
just to be clear for our listeners, hey people, pay attention. But for Russell, you know, he's meeting this student, and the student is awesome, and it's like, whoa, yeah, this is real, right?
He was what I call a prodigy in the martial arts, and that was only my opinion, but it was the opinion of others. Mm-hmm, and when I got in there, I was smoking a lot of pot and drinking and doing all the things that teenagers of the 70s did. And I was failing school. And he brought into some things in my life, like, hey, if you're going to be trained here, you can't be smoking pot. If you're going to train here, you need to get straight A's in school. And I went from D's and F's to straight A's in one quarter. It was really amazing. And he had that type of influence on me. And but during the training, they got into the mystical thinking of the group, telling us that John C. Kim had supernatural powers, that he could jump from a 11-story building and land safely, or he could jump from one building to another building, that he could heal anything. And that the way that they had killed Bruce Lee was that one of his instructors from Asia came over and injured him without touch. They sent energy through his body, and that he later died from that. And John C. Kim was a narcissist. And so the idea that he was Bruce Lee's teacher put him in the position where he was above Bruce Lee and Bruce Lee was below. It was that type of...
Right. And it was like a multi-level marketing group in a way, if I remember, because they would sell you on different levels of learning in the school to get you deeper and deeper involved.
Yes. And when he walked in, so first you have the master. And then you have different belt levels followed by rank and file.
Mm-hmm.
So automatically you have this pyramid structure that right off the bat. And what they did is first they started people with group lessons. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize this till they started training me on how to sign up students. But what they would do is they would have me, when I became assistant, is they'd sign up a new student, and then they'd go and ask me to find out about this person, and they called it sideways conversation. And so I would go to the person, I'd find out what kind of car they drove, what kind of job they worked, whether they're married, single, and I would get this detailed information on them, and then it would go in a dossier, and we would take their membership photo. And when we took the membership photo, it wasn't actually for that. What we did is we met in groups at night, mm-hmm. and we passed the photo around in the group. And everybody gave their opinion of that person. And once we got done, the higher up in that group would tell us what we missed. And then we would discuss on the ways to manipulate them to get them in to sign up to higher classes. And I looked at it, it was observation followed by manipulation. And some of the things were subtle, like, and I would remember that they did these things to me as they taught me to do it to others. So they call it
victimizer.
Exactly. And they had us believing that we were actually doing it for the person's own good.
Of course. I was lied to, and then I lied to people, like sucked them in because it was
exactly.
Ends justify the means.
Exactly. And that was a, they called it true, right, and correct in the school. And it took me years to find out what that phrase actually meant, that it meant the ends justifies the means. Mm-hmm. And so, like, say you have a beginning student and you teach him a move that he's going to practice in the mirror. And then you would take a more advanced student and you would teach him behind. So when that student is practicing the mirror, that he's seeing with the other students. And so you separate them and you make them feel like they want to be a part of that. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I got into what they're called black belt course, I was told I had to be recommended. I was told I had to be accepted. So I took the money from my high school graduation that I was given. I had to present it in a white envelope. It had to be cash. I could
of course, cash. No taxes.
Exactly. And the instructors, my instructors, had to say why they were recommended me. And then after I signed the contract, and nobody got copies of the contract.
Another warning flag. If you ever sign a contract, it's illegal not to get a copy of a contract.
Exactly. And so then after all that was done, then they would line up the whole class. And then they would bring me out, and then they would talk about how hard I tried and how I had earned this opportunity, and that if they had done the same thing, that they could also have that opportunity. And they play that, you know, you might not be accepted. And unless somebody was what they would consider somehow mentally missing, or a group that they didn't want being brought up in the school, like if someone was gay, blacks could only make it up to a certain level. As I was learning to sign up students, I learned the different things. Blacks were called well-done ones. Jewish were called hook noses.
Racist, anti-Semitic, the whole nine yards.
Yeah, yes. And
homophobic.
And bullies at the same time, because yep. I was a child with epilepsy. I was bullied all the time. And as I was signing up students, that's when they taught me that I had to get in on them, and that's when you make them feel pain. And that's where the dominant submissive relationship came in. And I learned, and it was amazing to me how it actually worked, in that once you hit somebody and you made them feel pain, how it triggered something in their brain. And we actually had, before these free lessons, we had a release form, and we called it the DDM form, for depth doesn't matter. And it literally said that you could die during this this demonstration. You made sure that they read that.
Yeah, and death doesn't matter, huh?
Death doesn't matter. The DDM
form. Here, sign here. Death doesn't matter. If I punch you in the chest and you die, whoops, it's on you.
Exactly. And the thing was, is as I went from assistant to assistant instructor, I did witness violence, you know, and so not only racism, sexism, all these different things. So I went in to learn self-confidence and discipline, and all of a sudden I'm being turned into the exact person I don't want to be. I'm becoming a bully. I did see violence. There was people that were literally assaulted, and then we would go to court, and hey, nobody touched them. And to witness,
well, let's tell the story. It's coming back to me, Russ. You told me about someone they were trying to enroll, and you set up the group set up some type of mugging or some type of assault on the street to make him want to come and learn martial arts.
There's a few different stories like that, Steve.
Pick one.
Okay. There was a student who signed up, and he was this black guy, and he was kind of like a no BS type of guy. And then he signed up for private lessons thinking that he was going to be taught one-on-one. Well, what that actually meant there is you get 15 minutes at the end of the class. Hmm. And so there's one day during class that he started swearing because he's like, you know, I'm supposed to be in private lessons. And so he gets called in the office, and then him and the instructor started yelling back and forth. And he didn't do that. And so myself and another assistant instructor get called to get his clothes. And so we go and get his clothes, and my instructor's telling him to get his shoes and get out the door. And he's like, you're not making me leave. And so then we're told to grab him and escort him out the door. So we grab him by each arm. And at this point, he jumps on the floor and starts saying we broke his leg, and we hadn't touched his leg. And I could see like a lawsuit in his eyes. And then my instructor, he goes and he grabs him by the throat, and he grabs him by the hair, and he gave him 3 seconds. And by the count of three, he kicked open the door with one leg. He threw the student in his uniform out on Lake Street, which is, it was a violent area. If you remember the recent riots in Minnesota, that's where they all took place. It was violent back then and continued. And so we had the student, and he was crawling in his uniform on the sidewalk, begging for help. And then the next thing you know, all of the people were surrounding from the neighborhood. The rescue squad comes out there, and yeah, I was instructed to say, we handed him his clothes and watched him walk out the door. And then...
So lie to authorities, basically.
Yes. And then what happened next was that he tried to sue us for the cost of his uniform and his lessons. So a few months later comes by, and we go to court, and the instructor and I actually get in the elevator. The other assistant quit. He quit the next day after this incident. And we get in the elevator, and then in steps this gentleman inside the elevator with us. And I can't imagine the fear that must have been within him at that time. Well, I would experience that later on. But then... we went to court, and obviously he had no witnesses, and it was thrown out. And I had learned at that time that that was their standard operating procedure. And that that everywhere around the country, that they had schools that existed at the time, that there was lawsuits involving students and assault. Mm-hmm. And later on in my investigation of them, I went to every court and pulled records, and I accumulated all this documentation for it. And that was one of the cases. And there was another one where I had a guy that came in, and he was a little different, and he wanted to learn how to levitate. And that's when I hit him with the head. As soon as set him up where we hit him in the stomach, knocked the wind out of him, he fell to the ground, and he started crying that, "You can't teach me anything." And this is like, you know, at the point where, you know, I'm reflecting in my head, like, what am I doing here? You know, because I had a very violent childhood. And in junior high and high school, I was known for, if someone was being bullied, I was going to take out the bully. And all of a sudden, they changed me into something that I didn't want to be. And
they turned you into a bully, just like John C. Kim.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of discipline in the school. And one of the things, like when I was learning how to handle a school, that's what they called it, an instructor would leave at night, and I'd run the class and I'd run the school. Mm-hmm. And one night he left a note for me of things that I needed to do. And he wrote the note, but he forgot to actually put it out. And so the next day I came in, and he was angry with me. He told me to go change in my uniform and drop down and do 100 push-ups. And these are push-ups that weren't like a normal push-up where you just push up and down. It's a combination of like a yoga downward dog movement. And what it did is it pumped so much blood into my tricep muscle that it constricted the blood flow.
I remember this. This is where you got injured.
And so that night I went home, and my arms were completely locked out. They grew. They grew like just a hot dog ready to explode. Right. In the microwave. And then the next day I came in, and the instructor, he tried acupuncture and acupressure to try to relieve the pain. And he joked about it because he had the same reaction from these push-ups. And he, you know, to a certain extent, he wasn't doing anything to me that hadn't been done to him. And I, you know, one time I remember coming in the school, it was below zero in Minnesota, and he's outside on the sidewalk and he's doing push-ups. And then his instructor's having him do this. And so he couldn't do acupressure on me, and he calls the higher-ups and tells them that something's wrong here. Then I was told I'd have to wait till the national instructors would be in town. And this is the short of, you know, the long version is in my podcast, because there's a lot of detail here. And
your podcast is called Deceived. I think I forgot to mention at the opening, but you've created this podcast. We'll definitely add the links to the blog together.
And the podcast, I think some people recognize all the sleep deprivation, the information control, everything that's in it, because mm-hmm. I kind of took your book as a format and told my story that way. Mm-hmm. So they believe that John C. Kim could cure anything. And I was living with other assistants and students and instructors. And I had believe that going to the hospital was like the absolute worst thing you could do because you would have faith in the school. So after 3 days of my arms being swollen and still having to wait a couple more, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I snuck out of where I was living and I went to the hospital. And my only intention was to get pain pills and muscle relaxers until I got there. And until they could heal me. And once I got to the hospital, the emergency room told me that I had what was compartment syndrome. And what was happening, that I pumped so much blood into my arms that it constricted the blood flow. And the blood was no longer flowing into my arms.
Right.
And my arms were starting to die, and this dead muscle tissue was going into my kidneys. And my kidneys were starting to shut down. Wow. And they told me that if they didn't operate, that I could die or lose my arms or both. And they wanted me to sign a release form. And at that point, I wouldn't do it because the school told me that they could cure me. And so I had the hospital call my roommate, who called my instructor, who had me do the push-ups. And he comes down to the hospital, the instructor who had me do the push-ups, and I'm laying in the gurney, and I try to stand up and bow to him to show him respect.
Yeah, we bowed in the Moonies too, another Korean cult. Please
exactly.
Continue.
And so he told me to stay down, and then he talked to the doctors, and then the national instructor said, because I was still there, that to go ahead and let them operate. So what they did is they cut me from my shoulders to my elbows. And when they did that, my arms literally did explode like hot dogs.
Wow.
And
to relieve the pressure.
To relieve the pressure. And when that happened, they put me out, and then I woke up and my instructor was there again. And as I'm coming out of surgery, I'm trying to stand up and bow to him again. And from that point on, none of the instructors came to see me. I was in the hospital for 16 days. Mm. And assistants would, but no one of a higher level would come and see me. And for three days, they had to let my arms drain. So I was in gauze, and it was just wide open in the back. And then what they had to do is they had to skin graft skin from my legs onto both arms to be able to close the wound. And they couldn't close it back up because it would have put the pressure back on. Mm-hmm. And so I was in the hospital for 16 days. I got out on a Saturday, and come Monday, I was back in the school and I was teaching class. I couldn't dress myself. Other assistants had to put me in my uniform, and the only thing I could do was move my arms and direct someone else to demonstrate the movements I was in.
And well, let me interrupt if I may, Russ, and just say so. Because I was in a near-fatal van crash, broke my legs, really damaged. I had one-hour visit with my team. Otherwise, no one visited me either. And, you know, the point when you're in a mind-control cult and you're believing that they have supernatural powers and they can heal you and they don't heal you, it's your fault. Like, there's something wrong with you. Right. And they don't even want to engage because they don't want anyone thinking actually what they're claiming is wrong. Right. So they just want to try to ignore the whole thing. But I wanted to flesh out this point because I'm sure a lot of listeners are going, oh, yeah, something like that happened to me, too.
And that's exactly what happened. Now, the other assistants did come down and they brought me pizzas and movies and stuff. I had Playboy, which is, I thought was kind of funny. I couldn't even turn pages. And, but when I got out of the hospital, I started to be asked why I went to the the doctor, that why didn't I know that I could come for the school to help? They totally denied that I ever came and was told to wait.
Right.
And so then I was starting to be blackballed. And one instructor after the another would ask me the same question, including the instructor who told me to wait. And you know, it planted a seed that day, and it took almost a year and a half later for that seed to explode. Mm-hmm. But to hear that you didn't have faith in school, and then they didn't want other students to know what happened to me. So a lot of times, like, we'd be in the dressing room changing, we'd make all the other students turn away from me as I was changing, and other people were helping me get in. And so during that time is when I actually became a first degree black belt. The injury happened in May, and I tested for black belt around September, I believe, of 87. And by that time, I was the worst physical condition of my life. Mm. I was probably about 30 pounds overweight. Mm. And I was always led to believe that black belt was going to be this, you know, level where you're going to, like, Scientology clear. And they used the word clear,
right?
You know, that I would be clear at that point. And then shortly after, I would meet John C. Kim for the first time in 8 years. Mm-hmm. And so I'm at home living with the other assistant instructors, and I get this call saying, come to Crystal. That's where the higher belts live.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go there, and I knew why I was going there. And there was like a reception line waiting to meet him. And so I go in there and I see him, and I see the short, stocky Korean man. And he's got this permed hair, and he's wearing a gold chain, diamond rings, gold. And then he has leather snake skin cowboy boots on, Adidas jumpsuit, and he had the porn mustache. And then it was really at that time that I started, like, a big, like, clarity was coming through, because what I was expecting, he claimed to be the second coming of Jesus Christ,
right?
I was expecting to meet that. And I'm looking around the room at all these instructors, right? And I realized that they all had permed hair. And I knew they permed their hair, because I had five sisters and a mom and permed their hair. So I knew permed hair when I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking.
So they wanted to clone themselves to look like him, in other words.
Exactly. So they all had permed hair. They had the porn stash. They all had the Adidas jumpsuit. And one of the funnier parts of it is he spoke broken English. So American-born instructors spoke that, because he was the epitome of the perfect man.
And yeah, I did. I spoke bad English too when I was in the Moonies, because that's how they talked, and we were told to be like him, Sun Myung Moon.
Exactly. And there's questions whether John C. Kim and Moon actually knew each other. Kim
wouldn't
had
be
claimed.
Surprised yeah. at all, because the Moonies have the World Taekwondo Federation. They're into martial arts.
And Junri, and all those. My research went back that Kim and Ri and the Lee brothers are several prominent Korean martial arts masters at that time that knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if that goes back to Korean Gate, the CIA teaching the Koreans that if maybe they were all in the same group, but they all came over here and went similar directions. So meeting Kim that night, it was interesting, because my instructors were always like you know, stern, hard men, and all of a sudden they're like children around him. And they made all of us that were there. There was about 30 of us, and we had lobster and shrimp. We were eating with a king, so we were going to be fed with a king. And it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and he's starting to tell these stories about living in a cave in Korea with tigers and all his training. And he'd start getting into these deep, deep conversations. And we're sitting on the floor and our legs are crossed. And any period of time, your legs are going to fall asleep.
Right.
And so he would be speaking. And right when he was going to get to his point, he'd say, "Meanings." And then he would go on to something else. As soon as you thought he was going to give his point, he went on to a whole nother story, and it went in circles like that. And then I started to see people pass out, and then he'd look and go, "See, too much mind getting in."
This is keeping them up all night long. Sleep deprived anyway.
Most of us, like towards the end there, I would go on 2 to 3 hours of sleep if I was lucky. I worked like several different jobs because teaching at the school. Sometimes I slept in my car going from one job to another. There was people who got in car accidents because they fell asleep behind the wheel.
Because you didn't make a living working at the school.
Everything went to the school.
You were paying them, not they weren't paying you.
No. Students did not get paid, and they literally, you'd have to give them your budget, how much you paid for everything. When I was a teenager, I did have a beautiful Trans Am, and they harassed me about that. They're like, "You know, when I was an assistant, I never had a car like that, because all I had was one pair of pants." Mm-hmm. And they would make you feel guilty for something that you earned. Right. And at one point, I was underwater on the car, so I called the bank and had the bank take the car back. So I could give them the money for the training.
Oh, man.
And then on Kim's birthday, we had to give cash gifts. I always found it interesting. John C. Kim was born on April 1st, died on Valentine's Day 2016. But the guy who had conned and fooled so many people would actually be born on April Fool's Day.
Right.
I found it interesting. And then, you know, so I was in the school for a year and a half after my injury. Mm-hmm. And one day I have a couple assistants that I know. They see me changing and they see the scars on the back of my arms. And they approached me and they told me that they had heard a story about a student who did these push-ups and was injured and went to the school. And the reason that they were scarred was because they didn't trust the school to come for help. And I learned that I'm being used as an example of what happens when you don't trust the school. And I knew for a long time I was being blackballed. Mm-hmm. The way they looked at me changed everything, but then also this anger and started to grow within me. Mm-hmm. And I was getting upset. And then when I was living with the other assistants, I was not being as respectful. Mm-hmm. And then the place that we were living was being sold. And so I had a chance to go and live on my own. And mm-hmm. I didn't want to live with them. And then so a period of like 3 months went by without me living there. And at the time, I was working 3 different jobs. And one day I'm at a job where I was working as a printer, and they told me to go out and learn how to do printing because they owned a printing company in Chicago. And the plan was not for me to be an instructor anymore, that I'd work for a Chumukwan company. Mm-hmm. And so I'm working at this printing company, and my shift was about over. So I had to call the school and I had to ask permission to come in. And so I got on the phone and I said, "Hello, assistant head instructor. This is assistant instructor Russell." Britta asked if there's anything I could do for school. School always came first. And then the next question is, and that would mean, you know, hey, can I go buy toilet paper, any supplies, and give you the receipt with the money that I paid for myself? And then the second question would be, does your self care for anything? And then they would tell me whether to buy them lunch or something. And, you know, we would be told that the instructors were making so much money that they're going to retire in the 30s. But in actuality, they were at poverty level and some of them couldn't afford their own meals. And so depended on a lot of the students to buy their meals. And then the third question was, be right to step into school now. And after I was told it was all right, I went to hang up the phone, and it was like a shade going up. This clarity came, and as I set down the phone, and my exact words, excuse the language, is, fuck it, I quit. And it was angry. It was, and then I went home, and I had a complete psychological breakdown. I had no idea what was going on with me. Everything in my instincts was telling me to run. And so that night, I unplugged my phone, and I dropped all the shades in my apartment. And I hid in the darkness. And a book that I haven't quite finished yet is called Deceived, A Journey in the Darkness. And it talks about how I found myself hiding on the floor next to my bed, curled up in a blanket. And why that was happening, they came and I lived on the first floor, and they were knocking on my windows and they're calling out my name. And this went on for 6 weeks. And I had
to. In other words, the cult was pursuing you, even though you said, I quit, I'm out of here.
I never told them I quit. I mean, when I hung up the phone.
Oh, you said it to yourself.
Yeah, that I quit. And I ran. And they were trying to get me back. And, you know, everything in my instinct was telling me that I had to run. And I didn't understand why. And then that was 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And I had 2 years to think about what happened to me. And then I had a good friend that was doing some just talking with me, and we talk at night. And I would go over all these things that happened, all the questions. And then 1990, I had reconstructive surgery on my arms where they're going to take the scar tissue off. Mm-hmm. And when I had that surgery, I was in a lot of pain. The first time I couldn't show the pain that I was in, but I was in a lot of pain, and I was angry. I was pissed off, and that anger was directed towards them. And the very next day, after the surgery, the phone rang, and it was an instructor from the school, and he was actually a close friend of mine. We went to junior high school and high school together. And what had happened is that they started franchising these schools. And he was asked who he wanted to own a school with, and he said me. And so 2 years after I left, he called. And I was so angry, and I went and meet him at the school. I felt like if I had gone down the school, it would be like going into a Scientology center, you know,
it was a cult.
And
full-fledged.
They believed that he was the second coming of Christ. They died and came back to life. I mean, you know, he said that he came here to fix the mistakes of Jesus.
Of course.
But you didn't find out it was religious till the end. And so what had happened is I agreed to meet him, and he told me at that time we met at a restaurant that there had been an investigation in Chicago that exposed the group, and he didn't know what it was involved in, and that they had to make a lot of changes from that point on. And after that meeting, he said that he'd get back to me, and 2 weeks went by, and he didn't get back to me. And then so I called him up, and he was like, Oh, did I say I'd get back to you? He said, well, they felt what happened to you was too bad, but that was about it. And then he said, someone's got to make a payment. I got to let you go. And I was so angry because, again, it was like all about the money.
Right.
And so I had made a decision when we met that I was going to get an attorney.
Yeah.
And so I made an appointment with the attorney. And it was a prominent law firm here in Minnesota. And the attorney, Kate Flom, she understood like mind control like right away. And she suggested that what you're telling me, you've been involved in a cult. They felt that I had a good case. But the whole thing was, you know, how do you collect off of this? Right. And so that night after meeting her, I went to the local library and I checked out Combating Cult Mind Control. And I read that book. I don't normally read books from cover to cover, but I read it nonstop. And then the description of the Moonies, the sleep deprivation, the information control. Chumukwan practiced information control. You were told what you needed to know for each level. When that assault happened, only the people involved were told.
Sure.
And the sleep deprivation, everything. It was all in there. And I had clarity that I was in a cult. And so then she put me with an investigator, a guy named Bob Wilson. And Bob and I went to another library, and then we started going through the books. We were trying to find this investigative report. Yeah. And so we went through all the phone books and we started calling martial arts schools, and not one in the Chicago area would want to talk to us. When we finally found it, then they told us the name of the reporter, Pam Zekman, and the investigative series was titled Chumukwan, the Cult Macan. And so we ordered that tape. And once I got that tape, my whole world was really like blown
apart. It was
apart.
Really well done, as I remember, and I must have it in my basement somewhere. I haven't looked at it forever. But.
And if people go on to my Deceived Podcast website, deceivedpodcast.com, and they go to the gallery, they're going to find the lawsuits. They're going to find the Comic-Con videos. So this is heavily documented. And
it's great.
So when I was put with Bob Wilson, that was really the beginning of my career as a private investigator. It led it, you know, in high school, I had a law class that taught me public record retrieval. And I went to court cases and watched them.
Uh-huh.
And all the stuff was coming together. Some of this, like, I'm a skeptic now. But then there's some things that I can never really explain, like how that phone call happened the day after I got a surgery. And, you know, so the universe somehow connected. And but that skeptic mind of mine questions everything.
I think it's good to be skeptical, and I think it's good to be open-minded. And you want to go back and forth and look for evidence. And you have friends you can reality test with. One thing we didn't talk about, but my recollection is like the Moonies, Chumukwan discouraged people from, you know, staying with their families, being in touch, going home for holidays and such. Am I remembering correctly?
You are, but there was certain levels of that. Not everybody was treated the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So there was students that would be like shipped off to other states.
Uh-huh.
Then there were students, like there's some people that hardly saw any of the destructive aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there, so I do know people that lost communication with family. One of them, I tell the story in episode 11 of my podcast, who died on John C. Kemp's farm, and his family hadn't seen him in years.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depended on the type of instructor. Now, there was a couple different types of instructors. There was a type of instructor that knew that it was a con job, but that the ends justified the means. And then there was the guys like me, and there was a lot of guys like me that believed it was real.
True believers.
True believers. And there it was like a test. Like, If you were to believe that John C. Kim could run from Minneapolis to Duluth in 45 minutes, which takes like 3 hours, then you're more gullible and easily to believe, easily controlled. And that was one of the sayings in there. But there are a lot of multiple different levels. And
I'd like you to go on. We have a few minutes left to talk about how he was convicted.
So after we received the Pam Zekman cult and con video, I started formulating a network of former students. I went public. The first thing I went public is the Boston Phoenix article, Chung Moody's, that you helped me do.
Rick Kahn, I think.
Rick Kahn. And that created a whole network of former members. Mm-hmm. And then the government was involved, the IRS, and I helped to bring Minnesota to the table. Kurt Chappell, they tried to sue me and Joe Zimhart and Kurt Chappell in Houston, Texas, for libel and slander because we did a cult counseling in there in Houston, and about 60 students left. And they, at that time, those students also worked with the IRS. This is a much longer story.
It's a much longer story. I want to mention Joe Zimhart is a former member of Church Universal and Triumphant. He's a colleague. I've interviewed him for my podcast as well. Good guy. And he was involved with helping a lot of people get out of cults over the years.
And a lot did some of the first interventions in Chemequan. And that story's, I believe, podcast 10 and 11. Joe actually wrote a chapter in his book about it, and he let me use that for my podcast.
Cool.
And so actually how all that transpired. Mm-hmm. And so I started working with the government agents, and my life became kind of bizarre. I'm working with special agents of the government. I'm on TV. I'm on news. And it was all driven by this anger, you know, my arms weren't completely healed. So I was like in pain till my last surgery in 2005. Mm. So I woke up in the morning. It drove me to do what I did. And during that time, though, I was threatened, attempted lawsuits, death threats a lot. They had wanted posters out on me. Mm-hmm. And I had to go into hiding several times. And what always happened to me, I had the cycle of fear where I'd be afraid, followed by anger. And at one point, I actually had to accept that they could kill me. And the thing with Chemequan,
I've been there too.
Yeah, exactly. And they weren't idle threats because first they made threats.
Yeah,
they had the ability to carry out the threats, and they did carry them out. Mm-hmm. Now the court records are full of people that were assaulted by them. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, I actually got court TV to cover the trial, and I did an email campaign, and so. The first day of the trial, I'm there with Pam Zekman, the reporter, and reporter Alan Levine from Court TV, mm-hmm. and me and another former student where the government gave him the CI name, the criminal informant name of Bruce Lee. We were pouring all these guys out in the lobby. Mm-hmm. And the trial itself really reminded me of what I'm seeing going on with Donald Trump right now. Because you have this man who claimed he was much more than he ever was, that he was the greatest that ever lived. He's a narcissist and all these things. And then when it got to the end...
Well, God has chosen him, you forget.
Exactly. and then... What's his defense? John C. Kim's defense was that he was this poor, ignorant Korean man who didn't speak English, and he blamed it on all these guys, these 13 defendants that were in court with him. And he needed, he claimed to speak 8 different languages, but now he needed an interpreter.
Parallel to Moon, when he was brought to court, that they had actually sued, I think it was Galen Kelly for a deprogramming, and Moon got subpoenaed in court, and all of a sudden he couldn't speak English and he needed a translator. And
you know, the amazing thing is they caught this on tape, because the first day of the trial, he's like, "Oh, so sorry, me no speak English." And then as they interviewed him, as the trial went through in the lobby, his English got perfect. And then when he got convicted, it was like, "It's not fair." And they're like, "Well, isn't it fair? It's not true." And then when it came to the sentencing, he was bawling, crying, begging for forgiveness that he meant to do no harm.
Wow.
Crying.
Moon never did that, unfortunately, before he went to jail. And it also was for conspiracy to defraud the government of tax revenue.
And, you know, I been trying to pitch a documentary for the last couple of years and having some headway, whether we'll get there or not. It's kind of interesting. A couple of feedbacks I get were that it happened too long ago, or that
tell them to do the Moonies, and we can add Chung Moo Kwan as a sub story, because the Moonies, you know, the Moonies gave Donald Trump over $2 million to endorse them a few weeks after January 6th.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And that the sons of Sun Myung Moon, one has a gun factory making AR-15s and pistols, car arms. The other one has a cult, the Rod of Iron Ministries, and says we need an AR-15 to worship God properly. I'm not joking. He wears a crown of golden bullets. This is my former cult.
Well, you know, Moon did try to bring all the American martial arts under one association at one time. I can't remember if it was the 70s or 80s. Martial arts professional John Graydon, he teaches professional martial arts and how to run a legitimate business. He actually went to this thing in Washington and they tried to recruit him there.
And outed it.
Yeah, and I believe in my podcast I interviewed him, and he talks about that experience.
Yeah. So as we wrap up, Russ, I just want to mention I created an online course for clinicians and for former members and families and such, and a very prestigious psychiatrist took the course, and he said, "You know, Steve, I'd realize I was involved with a martial arts cult." And I was like, "Oh?" And he's like, "Never thought of it, but it fits the bite model completely." I'm like, "Uh-huh." So I'm going to share this episode with him for sure.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting with that, because during the lawsuit, they had brought in their own psychologist who was also a member. And her testimony, she was supposed to give testimony why Chung Moo Kwan was not a cult. and she was in the room with Joe Zimhart. And so you can imagine our attorney had us all have a pad of paper, and Joe just sitting had her, these are the questions to ask her. And at the end of it, and I have the transcript, she admits that she does not know anything about cults, and that Joe Zimhart was the professional in that area.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Well, and then you know, after that hearing, that's when Kurt Chappell got attacked and the Intercontinental Airport bringing me to my plane.
So what happens with him? Now, is he the one who wrote Herding the Moo? Or is that someone else?
No, that's another friend of mine. Okay. And he went by pen name of Joe Smith. And that was actually an instructor who lived on the farm in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's quite a detailed book.
And you're gonna hopefully update it and put it out.
Yeah,
again,
right? I'm working with him to update that.
Great.
So I'll talk to you more on that in the sidebar.
Great. It's really great. So as we're wrapping up, you are now, aside from your Deceived podcast, you're a professional security consultant. Any last words you want to share?
I'm not only that, but I do work in film. I've been an actor for the last 11 years. I'm very well connected in the Minnesota film community. And what I learned from a lot of this is I use distraction to deal with the stress and everything. Mm-hmm. And I've learned that I can channel all the stuff that happened to me through my lifetime into roles that I play. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very empowering to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I can circle back to the very beginning, because you made a point and I didn't interrupt you at that moment. But at the beginning, people often say, well, I joined the group and I stopped drinking, or I stopped smoking pot, or the group taught me discipline, or my grades started improving because they told me I needed to. And so what I want to comment on that is it's you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And to understand when people are being groomed to get into a cult, there's often a lot of good things happen at the beginning, the kind of honeymoon phase that lures you deeper and deeper in. It doesn't start as an abusive thing. It starts as a positive thing.
I totally agree with you. Otherwise, why would you stay if there wasn't something that... And the other thing is like community. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to belong to something. And that's part with acting is like I needed to find something where I belonged. And most of my actor friends are all kind of eclectic. And so it's a community that someone like me would fit in. And I think community is a big thing that people...
Absolutely. We're social beings. We want to be with friends and colleagues and such. But I want to circle back again one more last time to Kung Fu and David Carradine and Bruce Lee and everything. There's a glorification of the martial arts. So you were wanting to be part of the elite, you know, and it wasn't just physical prowess. It was spiritual, you know, evolution, presumably, right?
It was. And, you know, John C. Kim was very well aware of that. He used the modern, he used all of that to manipulate people. The stories of, Asian martial arts, like they weren't just legends. And Chumaquan, they were true stories. And not only that, but they came from Chumaquan and everybody else stole from Chumaquan.
Yep. And lastly, I'll just say there's a whole bunch of frauds in the martial arts world because I see it. I remember an old one now, but Fred Lenz claimed to be a martial artist. He was not. He also claimed to be a master from the continent of Atlantis. I think Keith Raniere of Nexium claimed to be a martial artist, and he wasn't.
Do you remember the guy in the back of the comic books? He taught the death touch. I can't think of his name off the top of my head, but he was a hairdresser that taught learn how to kill people with the death touch, the Dimmock. of course, John C. Kim stole that as well.
Yes. So, Russell Johnson, thank you very much for sharing your story, your journey. You're a great example of post-traumatic growth, where you had this experience, you used it to help others. As you said, you've been using it to help yourself with acting and security consulting and other things. You helped to put a bad guy in jail. So it's a very positive story for me to share Russell Johnson, your journey. And check out his podcast, Deceived.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for today's episode of The Influence Continuum. I've been your host, Dr. Stephen Hassan. Theme music for the podcast is by Nasser Malik. To keep up to date with me and happenings that I think are important, please visit my website at freedomofmind.com. There you'll find in-depth articles about cults, mind control, and other relevant topics. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at cultexpert. If you want to develop a comprehensive understanding of these topics, I highly recommend my books, Combating Cult Mind Control, Freedom of Mind, and The Cult of Trump, in that order. These books are a culmination of 45 plus years of experience and will really help you grasp the complex web of undue influence. I have also launched a new 9-hour online course for anyone interested in a deep dive into issues related to recovering from undue influence in all forms. While this course is designed for clinicians, everyone can benefit. Remember, love is stronger than mind control. And thanks for listening.